Half Price Horror.
Hello, and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at Wes Craven's New Nightmare, sometimes stylized simply as A New Nightmare, from 1994. Written and directed by Wes Craven, and obviously that's a pretty big deal if you've been following along with me through the history of the franchise. Craven created The Legend of Freddy Krueger with the original Nightmare on Elm Street, but all of producer Bob Shay's efforts to lure him back for a sequel foundered on creative differences, arguments over profits Craven he believed he was owed for essentially saving New Line from bankruptcy, and a general exhaustion with the way his serious and somber horror movie had been turned into a campy carnival ride by what Craven saw as a series of ineffectual sequels. For many years, as both Craven and Shay recounted in the Never Sleep Again documentary from 2010, the two men weren't even on speaking terms. But in the wake of 1991's Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, which was intended to close out the franchise and very nearly did, Craven and Shay mended their differences, helped, as I understand it, by a little bit of the money Craven felt he was owed, and naturally they started talking about making another Freddy movie. Craven was still interested in an old pitch he made for Nightmare 3 about the cast of the original film being stalked by Freddy the same way their characters originally were, which Shay had rejected at the time as too confusing, but which now seemed like the best way to slice through the tangled thicket of continuity created by the previous five sequels. Plus, as I mentioned in my episode on Scream, this was just an era when metafiction in film and television was generally on the rise. The popularization of the VCR in the 1980s, the device was introduced a few years earlier, but it took a while to become affordable and widespread, led to an unprecedented level of access to film libraries previously unavailable to anyone besides rich studio executives and film school students. And after a decade of this democratization of the medium, pretty much everyone began to pick up on the tropes of the genres. The 90s saw a ton of movies about our relationship to our fiction, self-aware and commenting on the phenomena we saw on the screen, from The Last Action Hero to In the Mouth of Madness, and horror was definitely no exception to this trend. So Craven wrote a script with the working title of A Nightmare on Elm Street 7, The Ascension, which was promptly ditched in favor of something that didn't remind audiences of the six previous films in the franchise, and the process of courting the actors who were so central to the concept began. Robert Englund, who here plays Robert Englund as well as his fictional alter ego, although Freddy is credited as playing himself, was of course on board, as was Heather Langenkamp in her role of Heather Langenkamp. It's literally the role she was born to play. But her real-life husband, special effects artist David Leroy Anderson, declined to appear in front of the camera for this film, and a replacement needed to be found. The renamed Chase Porter is played by David Newsome, whose career as an actor has mostly been in small roles and guest appearances, but who's been a producer on reality shows like Deadliest Catch, Shark Wranglers, Wild Justice, and Airplane Repo. It's always interesting to me to see the ways that different people find their niche in Hollywood as their career progresses, and to discover all the cross-pollination that goes on as they get a close-up view of various aspects of the production process. Likewise, Langenkamp's real-life son Daniel was 2 at the time, far too young for the kind of performance that would be needed to play Dylan, and so an experienced child actor was brought in for the role in the form of Miko Hughes. Hughes had his breakout role in the 1989 film Pet Sematary as Gage. Interestingly enough, Anderson proposed to Langenkamp on the set of that movie, having met her at a rap party for Craven's previous movie The Serpent and the Rainbow. But Hughes was a regular in film and television throughout the 90s, with parts in Kindergarten Cop, Full House, Apollo 13, Spawn, and Mercury Rising. He managed the sometimes difficult transition from child actor to adult professional, and although he didn't become a superstar, he's continued working to this day. One of his most recent roles, in fact, was a fan film called Dylan's New Nightmare, where he reprises the character he played in this movie. A big chunk of the remaining cast is just people from the franchise playing themselves. Wes Craven is Wes Craven. Marion Madalena is Marion Madalena. Sam Rubin is Sam Rubin. Sarah Risher is Sarah Risher. Bob Shea is Bob Shea. Jesu Garcia plays himself once again, credited as Nick Corey. Tuesday Knight and John Saxon both make appearances as fictionalized versions of themselves. And although Amanda Wiss declined to join the cast, citing a low offer from the studio, she's nonetheless represented in the form of footage from the original movie. And Lynn Shea returns, albeit in a cameo as a nurse and not in her role as horror legend Lynn Shea. Really, the only other major character who isn't a Nightmare alumnus pretending to be themselves on film is Tracy Middendorf's Julie, Dylan's babysitter and centerpiece of one of the film's best moments. Middendorf hadn't acted on film before this, but she'd already done 139 episodes of Days of Our Lives. As always, the soap opera to horror movie acting pipeline is very real. And she went on to a lengthy career as a day player and character actor with a few standout roles in Mission Impossible 3 and the TV version of Scream, where she played Maggie Duvall. And although there are a few wonderful performances to mention as we go on, let's dive in. We begin with what feels like a classic horror movie cold open, as a mysterious figure in a familiar red and green sweater assembles a new, fully mechanical version of Freddy's iconic razor-bladed glove. But just as he chops off his own hand at the wrist and prepares to become a Freddy cyborg, we pull out to see that this is actually a movie set, and the mechanical hand is an animatronic operated by three puppeteers with a fourth FX technician doing the faked chop on a stunt prosthetic. Ironically, David Leroy Anderson, who is a legend in the industry with credits on at least three other Wes Craven productions, had nothing to do with this film despite it being about his real-life wife and a thinly veiled fictional analog of Anderson himself. This is another KNBFX joint, with Berger and Nicotero working directly on the project. Everyone's excited to be working on the next Nightmare movie, but things turn quickly lethal when the animatronic hand, which is, according to Heather Langenkamp's husband Chase, made with tendons and nerve clusters from dead dogs, comes to life unexpectedly and murders FX technicians Chuck and Terry, played respectively by Matt Winston and Rob LaBelle. And yes, Matt Winston is the son of special effects legend Stan Winston, and does really do FX work in addition to his acting, while LaBelle is a Minneapolis native who's worked regularly as a character actor since the mid-80s and was notably in the horror films Fido and Jack Frost. The set goes out of control, Heather's son Dylan literally vanishes into thin air, and the hand starts to go after Chase next. But just then, Heather wakes up. It was all a stress dream, brought on by an early morning earthquake that rocks the family's California house. Literally. Thankfully, it ends with little more than a few broken pictures and a pool full of sloshing water, but when Chase looks down, his fingers have a cut exactly where the hand slashed him in Heather's dream. He laughs it off, and it feels like we should get the title card to announce the beginning of the movie proper, only we don't. Instead, we cut to the breakfast table, where the family watches a news report on the previous night's earthquake, and Dylan mushes his oatmeal into the shape of Freddy's face. Heather is obviously stressed, and not just by the recent spate of seismic activity. She's been getting phone calls from a mysterious stalker, and it's been putting her on edge even though she hasn't heard from him in a few weeks. This was sadly based on a real-life harassment campaign Langenkamp was dealing with at the time. As I've mentioned in my previous episodes about the franchise, she was one of three actors who appeared in both the Nightmare movies and the short-lived ABC sitcom Just the Ten of Us, and when that show was canceled, a disgruntled fan began stalking her in an apparent effort to get the show back on the air. She moved briefly to England to get away from him, that's England, not England, and began working behind the scenes with her husband's FX company to lower her public profile, and I do believe the person in question was eventually caught. It's so weird to me that the most famous incidents of stalking in the careers of horror icons really had nothing to do with the movies that supposedly disturb people. Langenkamp was stalked over a family-friendly sitcom, and Adrian King's stalker thought she was an old friend of his who he'd lost touch with. Heather pulls it together and gets ready for a televised interview for the 10th anniversary of A Nightmare on Elm Street. And I really love the way that Langenkamp gives a very different performance in this movie than she did when she was playing Nancy. It's a lot more naturalistic, understated and subtle, and clearly using all the experience she's gotten over the last 10 years of acting. And it nicely differentiates the character from the actor while still keeping all of both Nancy and Heather's warmth and charm. I'm so glad she got the chance to come back to this franchise and show that she's more than the awkward ingenue she was in 1984. Chase heads out to film a television commercial out of town, and almost immediately things begin to go left. An aftershock of the earthquake produces four long, vertical cracks in the wall that look like slash marks, and when Heather goes downstairs, she finds Dylan watching A Nightmare on Elm Street on the family television. When she turns it off, by unplugging it, which is a weird little bit of overkill, he bursts into a terrified scream that lasts a full 10 seconds, ending only when the phone rings. And that's Nancy Stalker again, chanting the old skipping song from the first movie, and to make things worse, Dylan says, "Someone's coming," in a creepy and menacing croak just before another aftershock hits. Thankfully, Dylan's babysitter Julie shows up and Heather's able to get on to her interview, albeit with her shit clearly shook. A lot has been made of how this film is a precursor to Scream, probably too much given Kevin Williamson's hand in that movie's origins, but you can definitely see a little of it in the stalker's phone calls. You can almost hear Jada Pinkett saying, "Star 6-9 is ass." The limo driver, who's played with discomforting verve by Cully Fredrickson, tries to chat with Heather about what's clearly one of his favorite horror movies, and he describes the bloody violence of the original film with just enough gusto to make us wonder if we're not going to discover that he's the stalker who's been harassing her when they pull into the studio lot and she's hustled on to her interview. But just when she's getting into the flow of discussing her career and her work, she's caught off guard by a surprise appearance by Robert Englund in costume and in character as Freddy Krueger. He immediately vamps for the cheering crowd, who couldn't be happier to see the serial child murderer they so fondly remember. And I love all the fantastic layers to this scene because it's saying so much not just about Craven's own feelings toward his creation. This is literally the exact opposite reaction to what he was hoping to engender when he first conceived the character, and you can just tell he's quietly horrified by the cult of personality that now surrounds the living incarnation of nightmarish terror he invented, but also about the weird relationship Langenkamp and the other cast members have to the charmingly hammy Robert Englund. The second he shows up, Heather is instantly an afterthought in what's supposed to be her day and her story, and while she's classy and professional about it, she can't fully hide her frustration at being eclipsed by the horror legend. And in this case, that's both England and the character he's playing. By all accounts, by the way, this is kind of how things played out whenever England did appearances with the cast and crew of the Elm Street movies. He loves sharing his stories of the industry, he loves hamming it up and goofing around in character as Freddy, and a lot of his fellow actors are sweetly exasperated by his lack of self-awareness as he pulls focus from everyone around him without really meaning to. Basically, this is drawn from real life and everyone knows it. After the interview, England and Langenkamp head out to the limo together, and England suggests working together on a project sometime. Maybe her character's dead and so is his, but that doesn't mean they can't do another movie with each other. Heather banters, "What, a romantic comedy?" And England says, "Just because it's a romantic comedy doesn't mean there can't be a decapitation or two," which could well be a reference to his Phantom of the Opera remake. But their conversation is interrupted when Heather gets a call from Sarah Risher at New Line, who wants to bring her over to the studio to pitch a project to her. And I adore the way that everyone at New Line is so thrilled to get to be in front of the camera at last, with Sarah Risher, she's the one who is famously making phone calls from the hospital with her newborn baby in her arms to deal with money problems on the original Nightmare, bringing Heather in to see Bob Shea himself, actor in at least 3 previous installments of the series. It's charmingly goofy, but at the same time it's never overplayed. In front of an Andy Warhol-style print of Freddy Krueger, Shea tells Heather that Wes came to him with an idea to revive the franchise, one based on a spate of real nightmares he's been having lately, and she's the only choice for the female lead. She's anything but enthused, connecting Craven's nightmares to the recent earthquakes, her own dreams about the new prototype Freddy glove that it turns out her husband's really been working on as a surprise for her, and the general weirdness surrounding the day. And when she gets home and finds Dylan kicking and screaming and emerging from his nap to croak,
never sleep again.
In what unfortunately sounds like a Donald Duck impression, it only cements her concerns. Especially because Dylan's stuffed dinosaur Rex now has a series of slashes down its side. Heather calls Chase and asks him to come home, saying she's concerned about Dylan's behavior, and even though Chase is decidedly understaffed, both Chuck and Terry have mysteriously vanished, the moment that he finds out there was another call from the stalker, he agrees to return immediately. But as he drives off, the prototype Freddy glove he made, which doesn't look like the one from Heather's dream, instead having the appearance of a human hand skinned down to the raw muscle and bone with the blades extending directly from the fingertips, has vanished from the trailer. And three guesses where it wound up. Heather tucks Dylan in, reading to him from Hansel and Gretel. This is a minor motif of the story, the idea about our tales giving us power by allowing us to confront and defeat our fears in a safe space, and it's a very sweet moment between them. Rex is on guard under Dylan's covers to make sure the quote-unquote mean old man with the claws can't get him while he sleeps, and it's clear that Heather is a little uncomfortable with the idea that the movie she made when she was barely out of high school has now become a generational trauma for her anxious and neurotic son. Then she goes to wait for her husband to return, but he's starting to nod off while driving, and wouldn't you know it, when he dozes off at the wheel, he's murdered by Freddy's glove hand in what Heather at first thinks is another dream, but that turns out to be a tragic reality. The police call it a car accident, but Heather finds it hard to separate her nightmares from the awful event that claimed her husband's life. And I can understand why both Langenkamp and Anderson didn't really want him to play this part. It would have been a bridge too far. Now, personally, I don't know if I would have shown the gory details of the incident. This film is a beautiful exercise in rising tension, with Freddy slowly emerging from the narrative at a pace that's perfectly timed to make you believe that what you're seeing is real. And seeing a guy get Freddy's claws raked down his chest and stomach before his car spins out of control and crashes feels like too much too soon. But I understand that as far as the studio is concerned, we're at the end of the first act and nothing's really happened, and it's important to show that yes, there is actually going to be Freddy in this Freddy movie, even if I think I would have kept it a little more ambiguous myself. Also, still no title card. I can't stress enough how surprisingly unnerving that is. It makes you feel constantly on edge, like you're putting your foot down on a flight of stairs and finding nothing but darkness where solid wood should be. It's the simplest of narrative tricks, but I love it. Heather goes to identify Chase's body at the morgue, scored by the wailing of another woman who's just lost a loved one and the horrible sounds of the bone saw in action, and she throws up on seeing the gruesome slash marks down the chest and stomach. Personally, I think this would have been all the reveal we needed, but again, Bob Shea wanted a kill that played to the back seats. The morgue attendant is sympathetic, but it's clear that this isn't his forte, and he definitely doesn't feel comfortable having this conversation. We then cut to the funeral, and there's something almost dreamlike about the finality of it all. Because this is a character based on a real person, even if the names and details were changed, and because that real person is still alive to this day and in fact still married to Heather Langenkamp, you constantly feel like there's going to be some sort of reveal that no, he didn't get killed by Freddy, and we're going to get a supernatural swerve to bring him back. But instead, he's lowered into the ground, and even though Heather has a nightmare of another earthquake that sends Dylan tumbling into the coffin where he's dragged away into darkness by Freddy, she wakes to find the coffin still there, and her husband still dead. John Saxon helps her to her feet, she took a bump on the head when she fell, and everyone offers her their support. That night, Heather finds Dylan once again watching the original nightmare, seemingly in his sleep, and she wakes him up to another series of screams and his insistence that he can't sleep in his bed anymore or Freddy will get him. He sings the skipping song, but he insists that he heard it from under his covers before he ever saw the movie, and the one who sang it to him is trying to emerge into our world. His nose begins to bleed, and as Heather takes him to the bathroom to clean him up, we see that no one ever did plug in the television from earlier. Which, I mean, yes, that's a nice payoff to that setup, but it doesn't explain why Heather originally unplugged the TV to switch it off, and it doesn't explain why she never plugged it back in, even though funerals generally take a couple of weeks to arrange, and what we saw earlier can't have been a recent event. I know, movie logic. But it is kind of silly if you think about it for more than a few seconds. Heather lets Dylan sleep in her bed and tells him that Chase is in heaven when he asks. He asks her if you have to die to see God, he asks her why God lets bad things happen, and he asks her if she can come with him into his dreams to keep him safe, and it's a genuinely note-perfect example of the way kids process grief and heavy spiritual questions at their own pace in their own time, and you just have to be ready to roll with those big issues when they decide to ask about them because they will always, always, always catch you off guard. Also, when your kid asks you if you have to die to see God, telling them, no, just pray and reach out, is something that necessitates some follow-up. Just saying. The next day, Heather and character actor John Saxon chat at the playground about Dylan's recent behavior, and, well, I love John Saxon, and I can understand why he's in this movie. I have to say there's the least distance between the way he plays himself and the way he plays everyone in the movies, and it's kind of distracting. You legit expect him to flash a badge and tell Heather he's on the case and he's not going to play by the rules. Or something. While they talk, meanwhile, Dylan is playing on the world's least safe jungle gym, shaped like a rocket ship and with a hatch at the top whose only purpose seems to be to allow kids to plummet 20 feet to the ground below. It's as if they asked themselves, how can we make sure children play safely? And then did the exact opposite. Heather and John, who apparently have zero peripheral vision, don't notice Dylan until he's literally standing on top of the rocket ship, reaching as far as he can into the sky, and they get over there just in time to catch him when he falls. He explains he was hoping God would take him to see Daddy if he just reached out, and he's genuinely sad that it didn't happen, instead of maybe having some legitimate understanding that he narrowly avoided serious injury. And honestly, that's probably the most surprising thing to me as a viewer, because an 8-year-old kid can't plummet directly onto a 30-year-old woman from 20 feet up without at least one of them getting hurt. But we then cut to Heather getting letters from her stalker. Literal individual letters burned into newsprint, and she calls Robert England up to discuss the situation with him. He recognizes her descriptions of a darker, more sinister Freddy, having painted it himself, and he mentions that Wes described a scene to him at the funeral of Dylan trying to reach God on the playground. He says he can't meet with her because there's something he needs to finish, and hangs up as the painting of the new Freddy is revealed to the audience. And that's a feature wrap for him. Freddy will appear later in the movie, and of course he'll be played by England no matter what the credits say, but this is where the character of Robert England disappears from the film. Now, originally that wasn't going to be the case. In the screenplay, according to interviews with England himself, he was going to have a nightmare of being trapped inside a giant web with a horrific spider patterned in Freddy's signature stripes, menacing him as a symbolic gesture to the way he's been trapped by the public's perception of him as the iconic character. On waking, he would have left town rather than face his fears, and while I do like the metaphor, I love the ambiguity so much more. We don't know whether he dies, flees, or even becomes possessed by the monster we're getting closer and closer to seeing in our world, and there's something so chilling about that not knowing that I think it wound up perfect, even if it was a supposedly budgetary limitation that prevented the scene from being filmed. That night, Dylan sleepwalks again, and in Heather's dream, a razor-bladed glove pierces the sheet and descends toward her face. She wakes up when Dylan knocks a drawer full of silverware onto the floor, but the slashes in the sheets remain, and she's attacked by a still-dreaming Dylan with kitchen knives taped to his fingers. She wakes up, realizing it's all just another dream, but Dylan is actually down in the kitchen sleepwalking, and he's arranged the threatening letters into the phrase, "Answer the phone." When the stalker calls back, Dylan goes into a full-on seizure, thrashing and foaming at the mouth, and Heather smartly decides to bring him straight to the hospital. He's examined there by the stern and authoritarian Dr. Hefner, played by the late and legendary character actor Fran Bennett, and named after the head of the MPAA in a sly wink to Craven's many clashes with the organization. Hefner is quick to blame the movies, which is hilarious when you know where the character's name came from, and even though Heather points out that his dad only died a very short time ago, Hefner's still pretty sure it's Heather's involvement with the Freddy Krueger franchise that's the problem. There's something so catty about it that I can't help loving the whole scene. Hefner thinks the signs point to early onset schizophrenia, but Heather believes he's simply freaked out and traumatized. She tells him that if he gets better, he can go back home to her and Rex, and you'd think after what happened with the rocket ship, she wouldn't make the mistake of telling him exactly where it is and how to walk across the freeway to get there, but apparently not. I kid, but realistically speaking, she had every expectation that the staff of this hospital would be able to keep an 8-year-old child from wandering out onto a busy road, and it's not her fault that the answer was no, they very much could not. She leaves Dylan in the care of a nurse played by Lynn Shay, who in my headcanon gave up being an actor after Nightmare on Elm Street and went into the medical profession, and who has a very warm and comforting bedside manner, and goes to meet with the one person who might know what's going on, Wes Craven. Incidentally, the earthquake devastation she drives past is all very real. The 1994 Northridge earthquake, which killed at least 57 people, happened while the movie was shooting, and Craven sent his second unit team out to film the wreckage of several buildings to incorporate into the work alongside the models they made for some of the earlier shots. Many crew members who thought the models were too exaggerated to be believable were amazed and horrified by how seamlessly they fit in with the real damage they saw around them, and it adds a gruesome touch of verisimilitude to a film that's already blurring the line between fiction and reality. At Craven's tasteful LA manor, he explains that he's writing the script Stream of Consciousness directly from his dreams, which was apparently true, and that it's about an ancient demon who's taken many forms over the millennia to murder the innocent. The only way to stop it is to trap it in a story, which imprisons it in fiction until the story is watered down with a bunch of cheap and silly sequels made mainly to sell merchandising and promote some dumb syndicated television show. And the parakeet? The fucking parakeet? Are you kidding me? Who thought that was a good idea, Bob? You should have listened to me and left out the stupid scene where Ronnie Blakely got sucked through the door, and now I have to come back and fix your crappy franchise or else the whole world is in danger. Jesus. Okay, so it's not actually quite that overt, but it's pretty close. Craven is clearly using the metafictional story to air the franchise's dirty laundry, and he doesn't care who knows it. Craven explains that the entity in his script likes being Freddy, and it wants to take that identity and that avatar out into the real world so that it can kill people in Freddy's form. The only way to stop him is to once again imprison him in stories, and Heather's the only person who can do that because it was her performance that gave Nancy her strength and trapped him in fiction once before. He tells Heather she's going to have to play Nancy one last time if she wants to save her son, and there's a wonderful moment as you see on his computer screen the exact dialogue he's speaking along with a stage instruction, fade to black, that's immediately followed. God, that's just such a virtuoso moment of metafiction. Incidentally, I have heard Craven's performance critiqued here, but I actually think his subdued, low-key performance is perfect because when you think about it, he's the only one who knows that this is all just words from a script. He is the only person who's aware that he's just reciting lines, and it makes sense that he wouldn't have much enthusiasm for what he's saying because he knows it's been written for him to say. I love that touch. We fade back into Heather at her house, reading up on childhood psychological disturbances and realizing that Dylan is suffering from sleep deprivation due to his recurring nightmares of Freddy's return. The TV turns itself on, just in time to reveal that Chuck and Terry's bodies were found slashed to death, the victim of what's believed to be an apparent thief who was caught in the act stealing Freddy's glove. Which is such a clever way to explain away the supernatural events we're all certain are taking place, and really this whole movie is filled with that same kind of intelligence. Another earthquake sends the lights out, and Freddy emerges from Heather's closet to attack her. It turns out to be yet another dream, but it's one that ends with a series of slashes across her forearm, and she immediately heads to the hospital to check up on Dylan. She finds Julie already there, drawn by a dream about Dylan, and Dr. Hefner as well. Hefner asks how Heather got her cuts, and she explains they happened in the recent quake, but Dr. Hefner says they didn't feel any shaking on their side of the highway, and she's got a few questions for Heather about Dylan's fears of Freddy Krueger. Heather tries to explain that every kid in 1994 knows who Freddy Krueger is, which is absolutely true, but it's about here that we notice she's been gradually ratcheting up the intensity of her performance in parallel to the rising tension of the story, and to someone like Hefner, who's not directly involved in events, she sounds very much like someone who's starting to lose her grip. Heather storms out, frustrated, to visit Dylan, who's now in an oxygen tent after an unspecified incident. So we've also got a lot of the same fears about a sick child with an inexplicable ailment that we got from The Exorcist. Heather nods off in her chair and dreams of Dylan sitting upright in bed to say, "I'm almost there," in Freddy's voice as he vomits black bile directly into her face, and she wakes up to find him thrashing in bed as the doctor and nurses come rushing in. Dr. Hefner decides to perform some impromptu surgery on Dylan without benefit of anesthetic as the nurses strap Heather down, and the doctor raises a glove with scalpeled fingertips as we realize this is yet another double dream. But when she wakes up again, Dylan is gone, and her subsequent freakout is genuinely heartbreaking as the real Dr. Hefner explains that they simply took her son down for some tests while she was sleeping, and she frantically insists that no, he's in danger from Freddy Krueger. Bennett makes a very smart choice here by downplaying her earlier antagonism and being almost cruelly sympathetic in her explanation of the situation. I really love everything about her performance, and she's also great in the Never Sleep Again documentary. Heather goes racing down to see her son, and there's a weird undercurrent to the conversation among the nurses as they discuss Dylan's sleep deprivation and suggest Heather's somehow responsible. I mean, I understand that she's not exactly presenting herself well, but it's clear that there's no sign of physical abuse, and both Heather and Dylan have just undergone the very real trauma of losing a loved one. I'm not going to say it's unrealistic, because anyone who's gotten on the wrong side of an authoritarian system will tell you that it can get very nasty once they've decided to be suspicious of everything you do, but I will say, these people are kind of assholes. Heather decides to go get Rex, leaving Julie with Dylan, but she's held up by the cops who want to question her about her recent outbursts. Julie tries to stop the nurses from sedating Dylan, but they literally as well as figuratively go behind her back with some double needle shenanigans, and although Julie decks one nurse and threatens another, played by Craven's real-life daughter Jessica, with the syringe she took from the one she punched, it's too late and Dylan begins to nod off. While Hefner undertakes a frankly illegal interrogation of Heather a few rooms away, Dylan falls asleep. And then we get him. Freddy Krueger at last. Now reinvented in darker and more subdued reds and greens, and with a long trench coat that makes him look even more like the stranger from Wes Craven's childhood story. He rises up from behind Julie, unseen by the wide-awake young woman, and stabs her in the back from behind. She's lifted into the air by the knives, then dragged up the wall and brutally murdered while Dylan watches and the nurses flee in terror. And the thing is, this shouldn't work. It should feel like a pale imitation of Tina's death in the first movie, an attempt to recapture past glories and evoke nostalgic memories of the thing we all loved. But instead, it feels like an awful climax to the rising tension of the film, something horrible being birthed into the world and announcing itself with a blood ritual. And it's honestly one of the most shocking and memorable deaths in the franchise's whole history. This is peak Craven, and even though the movie has a relatively low body count, I will say that it makes the most out of every single one of its kills. Dylan's gone, having decided to retrieve his dream protector, Rex, and Heather leaves the hospital staff to reckon with their total failure to keep a small child under control and the inexplicable death of a visitor as she goes to pursue her kid. Dylan crosses the freeway in one of the most genuinely harrowing sequences of the entire series, even though it's blatantly obvious that it's all happening in front of green screens. Just the thought of what a speeding car could do to an 8-year-old child is so gruesome and awful that I'm not examining the scene for realism. I'm too freaked out for that. It probably doesn't help that an accident like this really did happen back in the 90s in our area, and although I never saw any photos, just hearing the witnesses try and fail to describe what they saw was more than enough for me. Heather crosses the freeway after him, narrowly avoiding being hit by a jackknifing semi in the process, and she actually does get a smack from a thankfully stopping car that leaves her bruised but essentially uninjured. She follows Dylan all the way back to the house, getting there at the same time as John Saxon, only he calls her Nancy and thinks he's her father, and he does in fact flash that badge. He doesn't believe her either way, though, because Freddy Krueger is dead. And so when Dylan disappears down a tunnel created by his own bedsheets, it's up to Heather to reprise her role one final time. I especially love that Saxon has a flashing siren for his car. And I especially love that the front of Heather's house now looks exactly like the front of 1428 Elm Street. Because Wes Craven sure hasn't forgotten who lived there. Heather follows the sleeping pills from the hospital like a trail of breadcrumbs, just like in Hansel and Gretel, and when she takes one, she winds up tumbling down a chute made of fabric that leads her out into a crumbling gothic nightmare of old stone and pits of dark water and bursting flames. It's a gorgeous set, cunningly made to resemble the Freddy film we saw in the very beginning of the movie in Heather's dream, and she storms through it to face down the ancient demon himself. Which is why it's kind of unfortunate that, as with the end of the first film, this is where Freddy's at his least terrifying. He looks great, don't get me wrong, and I would have loved to see another movie of this aesthetic for the character. But once again, Englund plays his pain with comedy oofs and ahs and cartoonish doubling over, making him look silly and weak at exactly the moment he should be his most menacing. Oh, and he hasn't given up on the snarling use of gendered slurs, something I was hoping Craven might get him away from. Even so, it's a pretty knockdown, drag-out fight, with everyone getting their licks in on both sides before Freddy gets shoved into an oven like the witch in Hansel and Gretel and winds up burned alive just like his fictional namesake. Although not before Heather has to climb a set of stairs that liquefy underneath her, as if Wes Craven is saying, "See, here's how you do that trick, Bob." It's not my all-time favorite climax, and visually it can't hold a candle to Freddy getting torn apart from within like in Part 4, but there are some visually inventive touches with Freddy's tongue extending like a monstrous serpent, and his arms stretching to grab Dylan, and his mouth opening inhumanly wide to consume him. I just don't think they hit for me because Freddy stretching like Plastic Man always looks silly, not scary. But I might be in the minority there. The dream world collapses, and Dylan and Heather fall back into reality onto Dylan's bedroom floor. Heather now has a single lock of gray hair like her fictional counterpart, and she finds in front of her the finished script of Wes Craven's new Freddy movie. As she reads it, she realizes it describes everything that's just happened to her, and she enacts the ending by reading it out loud to Dylan as the camera pulls back and the closing credits kick in. It's a lovely shot, possibly the closest Craven gets to showing off, and it's a nice, seamless ending that takes us back to the beginning of the movie in a lovely bit of closure. And yes, we finally do get the title card at the end. So technically the whole movie is one incredibly long cold open. The real film is just 8 minutes of closing credits. And will I hang on to this movie? Absolutely. Honestly, I think this might be my favorite film of the whole franchise. I respect the original, don't get me wrong, and I've got things I like about 2 and 4, but this one feels like a more mature effort, stylistically and intellectually, and everyone involved is doing thoughtful, intelligent work to convince the audience that what they're seeing is real. It's a lovely explanation of the relationship between our fiction and our reality, and it's really got the most to recommend it out of any installment of the series, even if it needed all the others to exist for it to work. It's kind of a shame that 1994 was a little too early for a nostalgic revival of the Freddy character, because I think if this had come out even 5 years later, it would have been far more appreciated in its own time. As it was, it barely broke even, and it wouldn't be for a long while before fans truly came to understand how special it was. But now that I know, I'm not letting it out of my sight. And eventually, of course, we did get more Freddy. We got 2003's Freddy vs. Jason and the 2010 remake. But because I've already covered those, this is my farewell to the Freddy franchise, and I gotta say, I'm not gonna miss it too much. It's just not my favorite. I don't love the things they did with it, even though I love the concept, and it just comes off as too campy for me for its grim and serious subject matter. I'm kinda glad to see the back of it. And that's the back of the 80s slasher franchises. There's still Child's Play, I'm sure I'm going to cover that someday, but that was only started in 1988, and it's really Freddy, Jason, and Michael that form the narrative spine of the 80s. So this is kind of the end of an era, even if, of course, the podcast will continue. And if you want to talk about metafictional fiction, the disappearance of Robert Englund from the narrative, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as Half Price Horror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, it's a new year, and that means a new Romero movie. And if 2021 was the year of Night of the Living Dead, and 2022 saw a new dawn, and 2023 a new day of terror, you all know what that means. Humanity has survived, and it's time for them to make a dead reckoning with their place in the New World Order, as we take on 2005's controversial conclusion to the Dead saga, George Romero's Land of the Dead. See you then.